Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. The 13th century Notre Dame Cathedral in April captured the world's attention when a fire devastated large portions of the structure, including the roof and the main spire. Back when Notre Dame was under construction about 800 years ago, the Newark earthworks had already existed for at least a half a millennia. Today, we consider Ohio's ancient cultural history within the context of Western European development. Brad Lepper is the senior curator of archaeology at the Ohio History Connection. His 2000 book is titled Ohio Archaeology, an Illustrated Chronicle of Ohio's Ancient American Indian Cultures. Welcome back.
Thanks, Ann. It's good to be here.
Allison Beach is a professor of medieval history at Ohio State University. Her research focuses on religion and society in 12th century Europe. She joins us by phone. Welcome to the show, Allison Beach.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
What was going on? I mean, we know they were building a big cathedral that would stand the test of time. But what else was going on? What was happening there?
Well, when the first stones were laid for the cathedral in 1163, Western Europe was sitting between the Second and the Third Crusade. So it's a period of religious violence to a certain extent in Western Europe and with points beyond Europe. But it was also a time of great intellectual ferment and excitement, great intellectual interest and excitement in Western Europe, and a time of a really rich exchange intellectually between the Latin West and places beyond.
It led into the Renaissance, right?
Well, medieval historians like to think of there being a Renaissance in its own right of a sort to the 12th century. But it's a period that generally gets characterized, the 12th into the 13th century, as one of humanism, which is also something that's used to describe the Italian Renaissance.
And a structure the likes of Notre Dame, how long did it take to build it, and how many things like this were there at the time?
Well, it's a like any large building project. Even these days, it took quite a long time, even longer in the Middle Ages than it would now. As you said, the construction really began in 1163, and it's never completed. I mean, no medieval cathedral is really ever completed. It's added to and adjusted and changed, but the foundations and much of what we think of as being Notre Dame were done by the 1260s. So it's really during that period from 1163 to the 1260s. And then, as I said, it's added to, it burns, it gets reconstructed. Like any big medieval building, if it survives till now, it's a fabrication of many, many layers.
And was it built with the intention of it being this great cultural icon that it's become?
Well, I don't think they could have imagined the kind of cultural changes that would have to occur in the time the building has been standing. And it's certainly any kind of building that takes on this kind of status as a cultural icon has significance beyond what its originators could have imagined. I think they'd be fascinated by the discussions about how to restore it and whether it should be restored as it was. I mean, that's trying to restore a river to how it was at one point in time. It's a very changing structure. But I think they would be fascinated by notions that it could have a secular meaning in addition to a religious one. But I don't know. It's a good question.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about cultural history within the context of the life of Notre Dame Cathedral in Paris. It almost burnt down a couple weeks ago. And you just heard from Allison Beach. She's an associate professor of medieval history at Ohio State University. Meanwhile, back at the ranch here in what was now known as Ohio, there was a lot of activity as well. And we wanted to know how they compare and contrast. And so we invited Brad Lepper, a senior curator of archaeology at the Ohio History Connection, to talk with us about that. Brad, what was going on here at that time?
Well, this was a time of tremendous cultural diversity. The cultures in Ohio were diversifying by region. And in central and southern Ohio, there was this Fort Ancient culture, as it's been called, confusingly, as it turns out, because Fort Ancient is a Hopewell earthwork. and the Ford Ancient Culture was long after the Hopewell Earthworks ceased to be an active place. So a Ford Ancient village was built inside the walls of Ford Ancient, and archaeologists excavating there mistakenly assumed they were the builders and named the culture because it was first recognized there after the site. So it's left confusion for the rest of us for generations now. The Ford Ancient culture was between about 1000 AD all the way up to about 1600, whereas the Ford Ancient earthworks themselves belonged to the Hopewell culture, sometime between 1 AD and 500 AD.
Again, confusingly named for something that had nothing to do with the culture.
Absolutely right.
Where does Hopewell come from, the name of it?
Well, Hopewell comes from the Hopewell Mound Group, which was owned by Mordecai Hopewell. So the site was named after him because he was the property owner. But then, again, that was the site where this unique, distinctive culture was first recognized by archaeologists. So by convention, the name of the site gave its name to the name of the culture.
You know, as historians, how does it change? And I'm really interested in what you think about this, Allison Beach. You know, when you know the provenance of something and you know exactly where it came from and kind of who built it, all things being equal, you know, how do you see the challenges for people like Brad Lepper looking at things that don't have, they don't know who built it?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, I think it's a difficult question to answer, and we don't really know much. I mean, clearly the records are better for Notre Dame than for earthworks. But for the most part, the people who built the cathedrals of medieval Europe, and there are quite a few of them still standing, were people whose histories and identities we don't know. But we do have a general sense of the meaning. Brad, is that less true for the earthworks? Is there a clear sense of the meaning of these things within the culture?
Well, that's an interesting question, and I just want to back up a step and talk about that we don't know who built them in the context of current debates that often involve wild theories about ancient aliens or lost mm-hmm. tribes of Israel. Mm-hmm. We do know very clearly that these earthworks were built by the ancestors of American Indians.
Mm-hmm.
But in terms of what they mean, it's such a puzzle because there have been so many intervening years of violent history, of dislocation, of mm-hmm. tribes being decimated by diseases and then forcibly relocated away from their traditional lands. So many of those links that would have been there in oral traditions have been ripped asunder. So mm-hmm. I'm not aware of any reliable oral traditions that speak directly to the meanings of these places beyond the fact that they are, like Notre Dame, sacred places, places that were deeply important to the religious beliefs of the people at the time and that are still revered and considered sacred by contemporary American Indians.
Including those in Oklahoma. We're going to be hearing from the second chief of the Shawnee Tribe of Miami in Oklahoma coming up later on in the program because it is an interesting link between Ohio and Oklahoma, and it's interesting how it's developing in recent years as well. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. Why, Allison, was something the likes of Notre Dame, did it reach the sort of notoriety it did? And that sounds kind of pejorative, but I mean, I guess, you know, just the familiarity that most people have with it versus so many of these other medieval cathedrals that were built.
Well, I think it's partially due to American affinities with France. There's a equally beautiful, in my opinion, cathedral in the city of Cologne, which is where I live part of the year, that's equally beloved by the people of the city of Cologne. But in America, I think the resonance has been because of a cultural affinity with Paris. It's also in a very real way, the center of Paris. It's right in what was the medieval center of Paris. So it's been kind of the cultural symbol of Paris for a very long time. And for many of us who have made our careers studying medieval history, an early trip to France, perhaps as a child or in high school, piqued our interest. Especially when we walked into Notre Dame and saw the light or heard the sounds. So it was especially upsetting when the cathedral was on fire for the medieval community, the medieval scholar community. But why, it's hard to answer why any one site becomes iconic. Especially, I mean, there are cathedrals standing in Rouen and Reims, and all. There are, it's not the only great jewel of Gothic architecture, but it somehow symbolizes medieval spirituality and medieval history for a lot of people, and also Paris and France.
Right. Brad Lepper, is there a sense about what among the earthworks in Ohio is the most revered, or is that one of those things that has been lost to time?
Well, by the indigenous people, it depends on the time period.
Right.
Because many people sort of lump all Indian mounds together, but they were built over many centuries by different cultures for different purposes. So I don't think I could possibly answer for the indigenous people. The Newark earthworks certainly, I think, are the grandest and most complex achievement of the Hopewell culture. And whether it was more revered than some of the other sites in Chillicothe or like Fort Ancient, I can't possibly say, for because the local peoples in those areas probably revered their local centers more.
And we automatically, obviously, associate Notre Dame with Catholics. When we talk about when you talk about something that's sacred in the indigenous Indian population in Ohio, what do we mean by that? I mean, was it a religion as we think of it as Westerners, or there were many different religions, or how did it work?
Well, I'm not sure I can give you a complete answer, but yes, I mean, in terms of religious beliefs, meaning those spiritual ideas that give meaning and context for your lives and the places that mark these important transitions in lives like marriage and birth and death, these places certainly were places where those ceremonies took place and where human remains were often buried as part of elaborate mortuary rituals. So I think by any definition, you know, broadly speaking, we could consider most of these places religious centers.
But they were all not all from the same. They're all in different regions all over the state.
Well, for the Hopewell culture, mm-hmm. since they're probably the most prominent, even though they're widely dispersed, they are built often to the exact same geometric dimensions. They're aligned to the same astronomical phenomenon. So it's like the different churches in Europe all being Catholic churches. I think Hopewell really was some sort of unifying belief system. And it's not a stretch to call it a religious system, I think, that had different centers across certainly southern Ohio and even beyond across eastern North America.
And Allison Beach, before I let you go, I'm interested in something you said that you'd be curious to. It would be interesting to know what the builders of Notre Dame would think about rebuilding it and reclaiming it. Why did you say that? What's interesting about that?
Well, because at first, my first reaction was rebuild it exactly the way it was.
Mm-hmm.
And then I realized how fundamentally unmedieval that is. When things burned or collapsed in the Middle Ages, they said, get out the hammers and the wheelbarrows and the sledges, and let's put something else up. Or they'd even knock down something. The place where Notre Dame stands, there was an earlier church. They knocked it down to build in something better. And I'm absolutely not suggesting that. I'm just saying that these buildings, medieval attitudes toward them, and then post-medieval attitudes are add on. Let it show its scars. Let it show its history. Add on something, a new spire, that iconic collapse of a spire. That's a 19th century spire. Hmm. So there's no reason that the cathedral can't incorporate this new situation, this new experience, this a trauma, I think we could probably call it,
yeah.
And build that into its structure. Because I think, in a way, I mean, maybe they would have just rebuilt it. But I don't know. And I think it's an interesting idea that this iconic structure could add a new layer on our watch and not just be rebuilt exactly the way it was. I'm not suggesting something horrific.
No, I understand exactly what you're saying. And it reflects the 21st century in a way.
Exactly. And modern France.
Yeah.
And, you know, the cathedral is not simply a symbol of sort of a pure era of childlike Christianity. You know, they burned Talmuds outside of the cathedral in the 13th century. Mm. So if you were a Jewish resident of Paris, the cathedral would have a very different meaning to you than, say, somebody, a merchant, coming into Paris as a pilgrim in that same on that same day or in that same week. So the cathedral can reflect kind of new realities without destroying it, without defacing it. I think that's a very medieval solution in a lot of ways. And if we want to honor its medieval roots and its builders, maybe the thing to do is incorporate the scars. I don't know. I'm glad I don't have to decide.
Well, that's really interesting. And Allison Beach, thank you so much for joining us today. I really appreciate your insights.
Thank you for inviting me.
That's Allison Beach. She's an associate professor of medieval history at Ohio State University. We're going to be drilling down a little bit deeper, not literally, thank goodness, into the Hopewell culture, what we talk about, what we mean by Indian mounds in Ohio or anywhere. So if you have a question or comment about them, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
I'm Mike Thompson.
And I'm Steve Brown, and we are the hosts of Snollygoster, WOSU's podcast all about politics in Ohio.
Each week, we chat about what the shrewd politicians at the State House are up to and how national politics affects us here at home.
Find out why listeners have called us a weekly must-listen. For a lighthearted yet in-depth look at Ohio politics, subscribe to Snollygoster wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. The Middle Age era in Europe from 500 to 1500 was riddled with religious wars and disease. And at that time, the region we now call Ohio was teeming with life. The Mississippian period lasted from 900 to 1600, and archaeological discoveries from that time reveal a largely peaceful society of many peoples. In the context of the mid-April fire that nearly destroyed Notre Dame Cathedral in Paris, we're taking a look today at the comparable period in what is now known as Ohio. Still with us is Brad Lepper, senior curator of archaeology at Ohio History Connection and author of the 2005 book Ohio Archaeology, an illustrated chronicle of Ohio's ancient American Indian cultures. Ben Barnes is second chief of the Shawnee tribe in Oklahoma. He joins us by phone. Welcome to the show.
Good morning. Hi, Ann. How are you?
Good, thank you. Ben, give us a sense, you know, from your point of view about the significance of the Newark earthworks and the Serpent Mounds and these structures that are kind of hidden still in the face of Ohio.
Well, they're hidden if you haven't walked them.
Right.
If you've walked them, they're just the fierce size, the magnitude, the effort that was spent in creating these places. So it changes a person if you don't share the dominant worldview or the story of what Native Americans are. These are people that were skilled in geometry. They were skilled in astronomy, in tracking the seasons, and just the ability to create this earthwork in obviously some sort of plan. You know, it can't be interpreted. It's really hard to go back in time and ask what these things mean, but you can see the geometry within these structures.
Mm-hmm.
And just the ability to manage a workforce to accomplish that task is just, it blows my mind. It's an achievement of humanity, and it should be celebrated across the world for what it is.
Yeah. And that's an issue that we're going to get to a little bit later as far as how they're celebrated and how they're not. I mean, Brad Lepper, a lot of them are on private property. You mentioned Hopewell is not named for a tribe. It's named for the man who owned the land that they first found it on.
Yeah, and that site, the Hopewell Mountain Group, is now part of the National Park System. It's mm-hmm. part of Hopewell Culture National Park. But many sites are indeed still on private property. And you know, some of those people have preserved the mounds on there. Some of them have not. Some of these sites are being plowed over even as we speak. So it's wonderful that we do have these sites that are preserved as part of the Ohio History Connection System and as part of the National Park Service that do preserve some of the most spectacular remnants of these ancient cultures.
And, you know, Ben, you talk about the size of it. For people who haven't been to these places before, tell us about the majesty of them and why it blows your mind.
When you're standing inside of one of the enclosures and you can barely see one wall and you look across and you can barely make out the other wall, to just understand how immense this was built. These structures were built for a reason. There were people within these structures, and I just cannot imagine how many people. It's large enough to fit a rock concert in. So I cannot imagine just the size and enormity of the amount of people that used and congregated in these places. These places marked the passage of our human lives. Every civilization all over the earth celebrates life, birth, death, the beginning of the growing season, the end of the growing season, coming of age. We all have our own ceremonies, culturalisms, rituals that we do, whether we're Catholic, Native American, Muslim, Jewish. And so, like people all over the world, the natives that built these places were celebrating their lives. And so the enormity of the population that took part in that celebration at this site, large enough to fit a modern rock concert, just blows my mind.
Mm. You know, the Notre Dame Cathedral has been, you know, a possession of the Catholic Church for centuries now, always and continually. That was not the case for the mounds in Ohio or anywhere, because the people that oversaw them didn't stay. They were forced out at some point. What do you think, Ben Barnes, the ramifications is of that, and how do you view that in the context of where we're headed in the future with these things?
So I'm trying to understand your question. Your question's about the lack of having
a caretaker. There hasn't been a constant caretaker for them.
I think that's one of the real tragedies of removal. I visited with I have a friend, and he's a Stolo community in First Nation community in Canada along the Fraser River, and they got to stay there their whole time. Every mountain peak has a story. Every stream has a story. Everywhere they look when they walk out their door, they see their place on the land and how they've related to it for millennia. For Shawnee people, for people from the Ohio River Valley, removal removed those stories. Within a few generations, the place names, the meanings behind those place names were lost. Those stories, the only thing left that we have of our place on those lands are these mounds.
Brad Lepper, what? You know, I grew up in Michigan where there were lots of – it was different. It was very different. I remember moving to Ohio and wondering, where is everybody? You know, it was different. You knew Indians were here. You knew indigenous people here were here for centuries, obviously, millennia. But they were all gone. How do you start to connect the dots between what the Shawnee tribe in Oklahoma is to Ohio, for instance?
Well – one of the ways is illustrated by the partnership that Ben Barnes and I have been working on, that Ben has shared some of his own ceremony knowledge about particular artifacts that were found at Hopewell sites that allow us to better understand them. And we actually published an article together about these five spherical stones that look like marbles. And in fact, the first archaeologist that dug them up said they were marbles. But Ben said they looked much like stones that were used to anchor a head of a water drum onto them. And we've been collaborating on that and actually published a paper about that. And I think it's certainly a much better explanation that they're marbles, which never made any sense. Mm-hmm. But the idea that we are now getting a better understanding of Hopewell artifacts based on what is being shared by the indigenous people who have some sort of ancestral relationship to some of the people that were involved in that, I think is really exciting.
What do you think, Ben Barnes?
Well, by collaboration with folks like Brad Lepper and other archaeologists from around the country, our friends at the Kentucky Archaeological Survey and elsewhere, we see these four ancient sites all across, which is a later period than the Hopewell that we're discussing today in regards to these. But for the four ancient people, their civilization continued well into the contact period. Mm-hmm. So for Shawnee people and that the four ancient people, that Venn diagram intersects. So we're really intrigued by the similarities between four ancient cultures and our own, whether it be the archaeological signatures of building structures upon the earth, or the way that fires are used and the way they imprint on the soil. And you can see that imprint hundreds of years later, and there's stories to be told. And if you don't have the contextualization of what you're looking at, and you can't talk to the authors of those stories, you can certainly talk to the descendants of those authors and ask, what does this mean in your context of your religious life, of your cultural life, of your ceremonial life? And there's possible interpretations that can be made. And we can use disciplines from anthropology, ethnographies, archaeology to help discern some of those stories.
You're listening to All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Tammy in Granville, you're on the air. Hi, Tammy.
Brad.
Tammy?
Yes, can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Okay. So, hi, Brad. It's Tammy from Granville. How are you?
Great, Tammy. Good to hear from you.
Good to hear your voice. So, the reason I called is I happen to be driving home from a family weekend, and we live on a property that has lots of artifacts. I mean, we find projectile points everywhere. And I remember I took a class from you years ago, and you guys told us to leave things where they are. And I see arrowheads and projectile points being sold everywhere. And I'm wondering, what is the significance of leave the artifacts where you found them?
Brad Lepper?
Well, the significance of that, and it's not necessarily leave them where they are. If you're going to collect them, keep careful information about where they were found, because each artifact is like a letter on a page that tells the history of the ancient people here. And every time you take a letter out of the page, unless you've kept careful track of where it is, you're losing part of that story. And if you remove enough of the letters from the page, you can no longer read any of that history. But if you keep track of where they're found and can sort of recreate what was written on that page from the records that you've kept, that helps preserve the story. But if you don't know what you're doing, if you don't know how to properly record information about what you're finding, it's much better to leave things where they are.
Ben Barnes, I imagine you agree. Leave them where they are, at least record where they came from. But how many letters are left on the page of the Shawnee in Ohio?
If you take a shovel to anywhere along the Ohio River, you will find some of those letters. Habitations are anywhere you find water flowing, anywhere you find floodplains where people would grow crops. You will find traces of where indigenous people lived. And to Tammy's point about seeing artifacts on sale elsewhere, the collection. There's nothing nefarious in picking up an arrowhead. It becomes when you start creating a market for these items and you have people start to go out and specifically dig for these items so they can take them to market. And then later on, it leads to people digging up graves to find pottery. You have to be good stewards of the land. And to do that, you just like you do not buy ivory, you shouldn't be buying artifacts.
Tammy, thanks a lot for that call. Anybody else? The number is 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. So, Ben Barnes, when you come to Ohio, what other connections are you starting to make between the stories and the place?
Well,
I actually grew up, my father was an engineer. I grew up in Southern Ohio.
Okay.
So I'm afflicted with the curse of being a Reds fan. And so it's
curse
something
indeed.
I haven't outgrown.
Yeah.
But whenever, so Ohio is not exactly foreign to me. I spent a lot of time in neighboring states like Indiana and Kentucky.
Mm-hmm.
And what always strikes me the most is when I'm in Southern Ohio or Southern Indiana or in Kentucky along that Ohio River Valley is the similarities that I see when I come back home. And I look at the lands that Shawnees chose to inhabit here in Oklahoma,
mm-hmm.
and just the hardwoods, the rivers, the streams, the similarities. It's like, of course we chose these places because they remind us of home.
Did they build things like the mounds that we've been talking about in Oklahoma?
We still build structures on the earth. We still build structures on the earth, whether it's a mound or the way the graves are made. Could potentially be, you know, someday be called a mound by people 10,000 years from now. The scars that we leave upon the earth are going to tell some archaeologist 10,000 years from now. Of course, they're going to find a Walmart parking lot somewhere. They're going to think that's an archaeological relic.
Yeah, exactly.
Well.
It'll all be relative, so, right?
Yeah, that's why context is important. And so for us, yes, we still have these religions. We are very fortunate. The Shawnee people still has our ancient religion. What we do not have is removal took away our stories of place.
We're going to continue our conversation. That's Ben Barnes. He's second chief of the Shawnee tribe in Oklahoma. Also with us, Brad Lepper, senior curator of archaeology at Ohio History Connection and author of the 2005 book, Ohio Archaeology, an Illustrated Chronicle of Ohio's Ancient American Indian Cultures. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. In light of the recent attention paid to the 13th century Notre Dame Cathedral in Paris, we're taking a look at the comparable archaeological history of what is now referred to as Ohio. Still with us is Brad Lepper, senior curator of archaeology at Ohio History Connection and author of the 2005 book, Ohio Archaeology, an Illustrated Chronicle of Ohio's Ancient American Indian Cultures. And by phone, the second chief of the Shawnee tribe in Oklahoma, Ben Barnes. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Ben Barnes, while we were off air, Brad Lepper told me about your project to recreate and the whole process of recreating Fort Ancient pottery. Why is it important to do something like that, and how's it going?
But from the Shawnee burial context that we still practice today, we can see similarities in Fort Ancient places. And even the architecture, the signatures that the builders of these Fort Ancient places left upon the earth, those post holes leave impressions. And the way they built the fires leave impressions on the earth. And we see that mirrored in our own cultural life. So for us, being able to take ceramics from that period and we can start to infer that the Shawnee people, you know, in these specific geographies, in these specific temporal periods, these Fort Ancient people are no longer this ambiguous term, Fort Ancient. These are Shawnee people. Our language is old. Our religion is old. And it's been, and the traces that we left are still present on the earth. If we can just try to read them.
Mm-hmm.
And through interdisciplinary teams of people that are archaeologists, ethnohistorians, people with specific disciplines in ceramics, we're looking at recreating the art that our people created. And just like if you're a painter, you're going to study the Dutch masters. So for us, our art begins with the Fort Ancient people. So what is Shawnee art? Well, we're going back and we're studying our masters.
What is distinctive about this art?
Well, we have to first define some terms. We're speaking about Fort Ancient people in specific geographies and specific temporal periods, because the Fort Ancient covers a very large span of time. So we're talking about those Fort Ancient people that lived on that cusp of contact or even afterwards. So looking at those, there is some of these villages, particularly ones in Kentucky, continue on for hundreds of years. They lived in the same place. And there's a paradigm that's present in these ceramic vessels. And you see it. You see it for hundreds of years. They make the jars the same way. And then they use mussel shell temper. Other ceramic traditions, some do use mussel shell temper. It's where you take mussel shells and fire them and crush them and use that kind of like if you're making bread, it's like the yeast in the bread. It helps it to hold together.
Okay.
And so for those mussel shells, while other people are using sand or grit, these Fort Ancient peoples are using a temper that is it is very particular. It can only be fired between 400 and 600 degrees Celsius before it starts to break apart. So they chose a very specific ceramic paste, very specific signatures, both chemically inside the ceramic and also artistically. And you can see that for hundreds of years, and you can watch that art evolve there in ceramic.
You know, in the process of doing all of these kinds of things, and, you know, Brad Lepper, please chime in. I mean, how does it complicate or enrich the process, the fact that these regions are now broken up into political subdivisions called states? Ben Barnes, does it help or hurt?
Well, I'll give you an example. You introduced us to the Shawnee tribe in Oklahoma. We're actually just the Shawnee tribe.
Okay.
We have citizens in every state. We have citizens in multiple countries.
Okay.
We negotiated treaties with foreign powers. We have Spain, France, England. So we are a nation of people. So our nation of people occupy these geographies, and our boundaries did not have this idea of states is relatively young one. So
right.
We occupied the terrain, and for Shawnee people, we existed in what we would now, it's more than 20 United States. If you're east of the Mississippi, most likely you're living in a place that Shawnee people were present.
Brad Lepper?
Yeah, I would agree with that the modern political boundaries of Ohio today that people sort of accept as real boundaries had no significance whatsoever for these ancient cultures. So to try to use those boundaries to in any way interpret what's going on is difficult. And the other thing is that Ohio has, among all the surrounding states, some of the weakest laws that protect ancient prehistoric resources. So that's very frustrating from that perspective, that just across the river in Kentucky and Indiana, these sites are much better protected.
Is that because the people who live there weren't driven out like they were in Ohio?
I don't think that that's necessarily the case. I just think that historical circumstances, like in some sites have been ravaged and were very politically, you know, important, that this terrible tragedy happened. The site was destroyed. Let's get a law to protect
this. Kind of like Notre
Dame
burning down.
Yeah, exactly.
Actually, and I can offer some context
sure.
to that. In Indiana and Kentucky, those tribes were removed from Indiana and
okay.
Kentucky. So the Indian Removal Act, you know, we jokingly refer to that your area of the country as a big donut hole where there's just no Indian presence. So in Kentucky, there's no tribes. Tribes are removed from Kentucky.
Okay.
There may be tribal people living there now, just like we have tribal citizens that live in every state, but they were removed from that area. And Indiana is the same way. With the exception of a small group of people, the Miami people, they had some of their group negotiated settlements so that some of them could remain, and some had to be forcibly removed to Oklahoma. And now the Pokagon Potawatomis, they've reentered Indiana because they're up on the Michigan border. And so that boundary is kind of a false one for their people. So, but the removal, what happened was after Brad can inform a little more on this, Slack Farm happened, and there was outrage. Was it the 70s, Brad?
Yeah.
And there was just nationwide outrage. People were seeing bodies being exhumed from the ground, skeletons being just tossed on the ground while people were digging for artifacts and ceramics so they could sell those. And state legislatures, were facing a lot of pressures. Indiana responded. Kentucky responded. They passed strict regulations. Ohio, with its multiplicity of mounds and public interest and having fairs and flea markets where individual skulls and ceramics were on display, chose not to take an action. Hmm. And we're left with that legacy.
Todd in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Todd.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
My question is, I was told in Chillicothe, Ohio, the mounds there that's right beside the prison, I was told that the mounds were in the location that the prison was, and I think it was originally an army base or something, but they were bulldozed over when they was building that, and the mounds that are up the street, not about a half a mile up the street, are just a tribute, that they're not the real actual mounds. Do you have any information on that?
Brad Lepper?
Well, there's some truth to that. If we're talking about Mound City, the headquarters there of Hopewell Culture National Historical Park, which is a semi-rectangular enclosure with a number of burial mounds in it, that whole area was indeed a World War I training ground, Camp Sherman. Many of those mounds were leveled as part of that process, but they... locations are still there. I mean, the foundations of those mounds were still there. So when it became a park, archaeologists did the work to redefine where those mounds were located and rebuilt, according to the maps, mounds based on the historic records, but on their actual foundations. So they're not sort of recreated somewhere else as a tribute. These mounds are actually on the original sites that they occupied, somewhat in the same way that we're talking about restoring Notre Dame.
Hmm. Todd, thanks a lot for that call. Anybody else? 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Brad Lepper, is there any, have any insights about why that happened in 1970, why Indiana and Kentucky enacted stricter laws to protect the relics and protect the archaeological digs, and the finds, I should say, and the sites, and Ohio didn't?
I don't know, but I expect it's politics. It may be that the local communities in those different states were more invested and more active. And I don't know why that would be, because Ohio has some of the most spectacular mounds right. in all of eastern North America. So I don't really know why. But archaeologists and other partners now are trying to get legislation introduced now, finally, to show that we are going to have a level of protection that's somewhat comparable to what other states do.
Ben Barnes, in Oklahoma, do school children learn about Ohio?
You know, absolutely not. You know, they teach Oklahoma history, and like all public school systems, you know, they're pressed for resources and mm-hmm. pressed for time. And so there is Oklahoma is home to 39 tribes. So you could learn about one tribe a year, which would not be enough time, and mm-hmm. graduate, and you would never hear about all of Oklahoma's tribes.
You know, if you teach children about the history of Shawnee or anything indigenous like that, how would you do it, Ben?
Well, that is a problem with the internet today, and anyone's able to tell a story. Mm-hmm. You know, you have to be able to discern the truth. So what you can do is, for people that are truly interested, you know, you go to works, people that have actually worked with the community, not worked on. We're not sets of data. We're people. So you want to find people that tell our stories with us, don't tell the stories on us. So we have some really good partners that we work with, like Steve Warren at the University of Iowa, Dr. Brad Lepper there in Ohio, Dave Pollock, Gwen Henderson, and then Kentucky. We have lots of allies across the country that have worked with us, including our good friends at Indiana University. So universities are turning towards tribal nations. We are telling stories together, but it's only because of a willingness on both parties to tell the truth of the story. Mm-hmm. And I think that's what people really want. And they're really interested. And they want the truth. They don't want the myth. They want to know what really happened.
The truth is so much more interesting, right?
Far more interesting.
Jeff in Chillicothe, you're on the air. Hi, Jeff.
Hi. I have a undisclosed area. I don't want anybody to know about it, but I have a huge farm, and I was just hiking in the woods yesterday, and I found what appears to be some pretty large mounds in between two, it's hidden. You can't see it from anywhere unless you go down in this, it's like a gap, big, huge area, and it's really close to a river. And I was wondering where I have found baskets, literally, of 500 to 600-year-old arrowheads and pieces of them. I don't think they were hunting there, But there's all different kinds, and you can tell right where they were sitting on the riverbank, they were chipping them because there's big leftover pieces of flint that are not from the area, and even this black-looking glass stuff. Can you tell me what if that was the Shawnees or who that might have been?
What do we know, Brad Lepper?
Well, it's hard to say. We can if there are certain kinds of tools like the pottery that Ben was talking about. If the styles of the pottery can inform us about what culture was there, whether it was an ancient culture or a more recent historic culture. The styles of spear points or arrowheads that are found there can help us and inform us about that. So we would have to see at least photographs or actually ideally see the actual specimens to give you an informed conclusion about that.
When you hear from someone like Jeff in Chillicothe, what is your recommendations they do? Can they contact you privately? And
absolutely. I mean, my email address, my contact information is available online at the Ohio History Connections webpage. So, yeah, contact me if you
don't.
And you
can keep it confidential?
Yeah, we can absolutely keep it confidential. Ideally, we would like to have it recorded, but that's not a condition. We're sort of trying to serve the public. So whatever conditions apply, we'll be happy to try and help as much best we can.
All right. Jeff, thank you so much. Let's see, another call. Thaddeus in Cincinnati, I think. Hi,
yeah.
Thaddeus.
Hi.
Hi.
I just heard there was 39 tribes in Oklahoma.
Uh-huh.
Am I correct?
Ben Barnes?
That is correct.
Okay.
38 of these tribes, most of the tribes are removed to here.
That's my big question. Roughly, how many tribes was in North America total? That's an awful lot of tribes being in one area.
Well, some of these tribes now are political subdivisions that are not, like there's Eastern Shawnees, there's Absentee Shawnees, and then there's us, the Shawnee tribes. So it's three Shawnee tribes, and that's because of the way that they were moved during the removal period, and they created three separate political entities. Where at one time it had a much more dynamic structure than that. But now people today know of them as the three entities for the Shawnee people. So we have people from the southeast, we have people from the west, which people here in Oklahoma that are removed from Kansas. I mean, excuse me, removed from California as well as Kansas.
Thaddeus, thanks for that call. The Newark Earthworks has been in the running for UNESCO World Heritage Site status for many years, and Serpent Mounds is on the U.S. tentative list. What's the status of that, Brad Lepper, and what's the significance of it?
Sure. And I want to make clear, though, that it's not just the Newark Earthworks. The nomination is called the Hopewell
right.
Ceremonial Earthworks. It includes Newark. It includes Fort Ancient and the five sites that make up Hopewell Culture National Historical Park. And that nomination is moving forward. We were informed by the Department of the Interior that we're going to be next on the list or next to be nominated, providing we put together the dossier, which is like the nomination document that's almost like a dissertation to support that nomination. And certain other conditions are met. We're hoping that's going to be going forward in the next few years.
What is the significance of something like that to your scholarship, Ben Barnes? How does it matter?
The UNESCO, by having these places as a World Heritage Site, these places are as important for Native peoples as the cobblestone is for Muslim people, or the Western Wall is for Jewish people, or as Notre Dame is for Francis Catholics or Catholics the world over. These places were created by Native citizens and used for centuries, if not a millennia, as gathering places, as very special places. So rather than playing golf on them, I can't imagine us playing golf at Gettysburg. I can't imagine us, you know, going to sacred sites, playing or having someone propose, you know, Notre Dame's kind of in the way. Let's bulldoze that and let's make a theme park or let's make a golf course out of it. No one would suggest that. But here we are with the golf course on top of one of the most important religious, astronomical, scientifically important sites for Native Americans here in the United States.
I've just about that's Ben Barnes, second chief of the Shawnee. He is calling. We're talking to him by phone from Oklahoma. And Brad Lepper, we've got about 20 seconds left. Any final thoughts?
Sure. I just wanted to add to Ben's earlier point that the kids in Oklahoma aren't being taught about Ohio. If these sites become World Heritage Sites, perhaps they will.
Okay.
Perhaps they will.
Brad Lepper, Senior Curator of Archaeology at Ohio History Connection. Thanks to both of you for joining us today. I really appreciate your time.
Thank you.
And thanks to Sophie Warner for producing this show. That's it. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.